whatever you do.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. At least 78 people are dead and dozens more injured after a stampede in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Yemen's Houthi rebels say the stampede happened late Wednesday at an event to distribute financial aid in the old city of Sana'a. An official says the event was organized by merchants without coordination with the local authorities. Two witnesses told the Associated Press the tragedy was sparked when armed Houthis fired into the air in an attempt at crowd control, apparently striking an electrical wire and causing it to explode. The donations amounted to just about $9 per person. The Houthi-run Interior Ministry says it has detained two organizers. There was fighting in Sudan's capital on Wednesday night, despite both sides announcing they would abide by a new 24-hour ceasefire. A previous attempt at a truce failed a day earlier. The new ceasefire attempt came as alarm was growing that millions of Sudanese were on the brink of disaster from the past 5 days of warfare between the country's two most powerful generals. The fighting grew less intense in the first hours after the ceasefire took effect at 6 p.m. local time, with sporadic clashes continuing in the city center. The U.S. medically approved abortion pill mifepristone will continue to be available for now, Reuters correspondent Tamara Lindstrom explains.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito on Wednesday paused court rulings that limited access to the pill. Those lower court decisions came after anti-abortion groups challenged the drug's two-decade-long regulatory approval. Alito's decision gives the justices more time to consider requests by President Joe Biden's administration and the pill's manufacturer to block an April 7th injunction issued by conservative District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek in Texas that would greatly limit the availability of mifepristone while the case is litigated.
That was Reuters correspondent Tamara Lindstrom, and this is VOA News. An Argentine court says eight healthcare professionals will stand trial in the death of soccer great Diego Maradona. AP correspondent Lawrence Brooks reports.
Three judges of an appeals court confirmed the charges of homicide by negligence brought by prosecutors against members of Maradona's medical team. A medical board's report previously given to prosecutors claims Maradona was in agony for more than 12 hours, did not receive adequate treatment, and could still be alive if he had been properly hospitalized. The date of the trial hasn't been set, but it's unlikely to begin before next year. Maradona, who famously won the World Cup with Argentina in 1986, died of a heart attack aged 60 in late 2020, following brain surgery 2 weeks earlier. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
Andrew Lester, the elderly white man accused of shooting Ralph Earl, a black teenager, pleaded not guilty in his first court appearance in the U.S. Midwestern state of Missouri Wednesday. The 84-year-old Lester has been charged with first-degree assault and armed criminal action in the shooting, which has attracted presidential attention and renewed national debate about gun policies. Lester turned himself in Tuesday and was later released on bond after agreeing to relinquish any weapons and to have no contact with Earl or his family. Scientists are racing to collect data to understand how the fastest warming place on Earth is changing and what those changes could mean for the planet's future. Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones reports.
The world's northernmost research station, located in Ny-Ålesund, a tiny town high above the Arctic Circle on Norway's Svalbard archipelago, is also the fastest warming place on Earth. Scientists have been collecting meteorological data at the Ny-Ålesund research station for over 40 years. But nowadays, researchers hoping to harvest ice cores are finding glaciers inundated by water.
That was Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. A rare solar eclipse will cross over remote parts of Australia, Indonesia, and East Timor on Thursday. The hybrid solar eclipse will sweep from the Indian Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. The celestial event will shift between a total solar eclipse and a ring of fire eclipse as the moon's shadow moves across the Earth's surface. These kinds of eclipses happen about once a decade when the moon and the sun are almost the exact same size in the sky. Other eclipses coming up in October and next April will pass over millions of people in the Americas. For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. You can also download an app. Just search for VOA News. I'm Richard Green reporting for VOA News.
Today's Thursday, April 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gina Ruffo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine's top prosecutor describes alleged war crimes in Russia to U.S. lawmakers as Washington sends more aid to Kyiv.
As of today, we have registered close to 80,000 cases of war crimes. Evidence of these crimes, however, is growing exponentially.
Countries begin plans to evacuate citizens from Sudan as hopes for a ceasefire fades.
Fighting could be heard throughout the night in Khartoum and into Wednesday, despite both sides agreeing that a 24-hour ceasefire could start overnight.
And dozens killed in a stampede in Yemen. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine's top prosecutor has described for U.S. lawmakers examples of war atrocities that he says are deliberately orchestrated by Russian forces to sow terror among civilians. Prosecutor General Andrei Kostin tells the House committee that nearly 80,000 cases of war crimes have been registered in Ukraine. He says authorities have found torture chambers and survivors have reported an array of abuses, including electric shock, waterboarding, and threats of mutilation and death. Russia has denied committing war crimes or attacking civilians.
As of today, we have registered close to 80,000 cases of war crimes. Evidence of these crimes, however, is growing exponentially. Torture chambers. We have discovered approximately 20 such locations and even more unlawful detention facilities. Over 1,000 torture chamber survivors submitted their evidences. Survivors report that Russian forces subjected them to different forms of abuse, including beating with sticks and rubber batons, use of electric shocks, waterboarding, stripping them naked, threats of death or mutilation, and others.
That's Ukraine's Prosecutor General Andrei Kostin. The U.S. is sending Ukraine about $325 million in additional military aid, including an enormous amount of artillery rounds and ammunition, as the launch of the spring offensive against Russian forces approaches. The U.S. has declined to say exactly how much munitions will be sent to Ukraine, but the latest package resembles other recent deliveries, which included rockets for the high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, and howitzers, as well as an array of other missiles and anti-tank weapons. It will be pulled from the Pentagon stock so it can go quickly to the front lines. The Baltic countries have remained an important source of support for Ukraine as Russia's assault drags on. In Latvia, people have kept up efforts to assist the Ukrainian military while accepting Ukrainian refugees and making them feel welcome in an exile that for many seems to have no end. Marcus Hurton narrates this report by Ricardo Makina in the Latvian capital, Riga.
When the war broke out, Reninis Poznaks, a businessman in Riga, decided to help the Ukrainian troops by providing cars donated by his friends. He posted an ad on Twitter. More than a year later, the Latvian response has exceeded any expectations.
I was hoping that people will donate for two, maybe, cars. So now we are at 1,040, I guess, or something like that.
These cars, most of them with four-wheel drive, will serve at the front, some as tactical vehicles, others as ambulances. Their life expectancies in Ukraine are very limited. Most are destroyed or seriously damaged within a few months. That is why these volunteers are now building a special vehicle for the Ukrainian forces, an innovation they tell us is indispensable. Reninis Poznaks is the promoter of this initiative, known as Twitter Convoys.
Well, we all understand that Ukraine is also fighting for us, for our future and freedom, because we know Russia very, very well. We know that they will not stop if they will not be stopped.
Many families come to this non-governmental organization called Your Friends in search of clothes, toys, household appliances, anything that can make the exile into which Putin's bombs have forced them a little more bearable. The United Nations says more than 40,000 people have sought refuge in this country of just over 1.8 million. Alexandra Yasenova is a volunteer at the NGO on the outskirts of Riga. She says they work to assist two completely different groups, the Ukrainian families in Latvia and the Ukrainian army at the front. She says the army is currently a priority for us. It means that we supply a great deal of consignments for the army in particular. These are thermal underwear, the paraffin stoves that are also used for heating and as a source of light. They can also be used as a small hot plate to heat up food. But perhaps one of the greatest benefits that Latvia can offer Ukrainians is integration and not making them feel dependent on aid and charity. At the Latvian National Opera and Ballet Theater, several artists have been offered work. Among them is Angelina, a dancer from Kharkiv who fled to Latvia at the beginning of the war and who from the very beginning wanted to be independent. Her dream is to return soon to a peaceful Ukraine. She says, I so much wish this war will be ended as soon as possible, because every day it means human lives are being taken. Civilians are dying, as well as very many military. We are just fighting for our country to be able to exist, to recover peace in the country, independence and freedom that have always belonged to us. With Putin's war in Ukraine in its second year, the solidarity effort of the Europeans will continue to be necessary for a long time. For Ricardo Marquina in Riga, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
Fighting raged in the Sudanese capital of Khartoum after the warring parties locked in a power struggle failed to uphold an overnight ceasefire. Doctors say 5 days of clashes between Sudan's military and the paramilitary rapid support forces have left more than 200 people dead and around 2,000 injured. The RSF has announced another 24-hour ceasefire for late Wednesday as residents flee to the suburbs. Michael Latit reports from Khartoum.
Fighting could be heard throughout the night in Khartoum and into Wednesday, despite both sides agreeing that a 24-hour ceasefire could start overnight. Sudan's Ministry of Health Emergency Operations Center said the clashes between the military and rapid support forces left 270 people dead and 2,600 injured across the country. The ongoing fighting makes it impossible for VOA to verify casualty figures. Most of the casualties are in Khartoum, where the fighting has stopped essential services like power and water and forced most hospitals to close. Thousands of Khartoum residents are fleeing into suburbs or even further. Speaking to VOA Wednesday, a man who called himself Murtada said he and his wife were leaving for Kassala in eastern Sudan. He said Sudanese leaders had an opportunity to rebuild the country but were instead destroying it. Murtada says they had a very poor economy and an opportunity to rebuild that and provide citizens with basic needs. We are now traveling, he says, adding, even though we are scared because we don't know how the situation along the road. His wife, Manal Hassan, tells VOA she is surprised to see Sudanese killing each other. She blames the warring generals, RSF leader Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo, known as Himeti, and Sudan's military leader Abdul Fattah al-Burhan. I want to tell Himeti and al-Burhan to come to their senses and stop the fighting immediately, says Hassan. She says the victims from both sides are Sudanese. Hassan says both leaders are fighting for power. This is not an external attack on the country, she says, and asks, why do we kill ourselves? Khartoum resident Ahmed al-Sudani says the clashes have stopped his business of selling aluminium and that he can no longer provide for his family of six. He tells VOA they are fleeing to neighboring Al Jazeera state in the southeast because the situation is becoming worse. Sudani says the ongoing fighting is wrong from both sides. He says, we are supposed to put our hands together to build this country. Haj Hamad is a lecturer at Sudanese Center for African and Asian Studies in Khartoum. He tells VOA the ceasefire could not hold because both parties were trying to control strategic areas and gain more territory before any dialogue.
The area of fighting is sovereign institutions. We call it the sovereign area, which is military command headquarters and the Khartoum airport and the palace. These are kind of institutions.
The Rapid Support Forces announced Wednesday afternoon they had agreed to another 24-hour ceasefire from 6 p.m. Khartoum's time. It wasn't immediately clear if Sudan's army had agreed to the truce or if this latest attempt stood a battle chance of holding. Michael Atid for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
A new attempt at a ceasefire and the fierce fighting between Sudanese troops and paramilitary forces in Khartoum failed on Wednesday, leaving people fearful about dwindling food supplies and a breakdown in medical services. Several Western countries are planning to secure or evacuate their citizens if the security situation worsens. The State Department has established a Sudan Military Conflict Task Force to oversee planning, management, and logistics related to the events in Sudan, but has not indicated plans to evacuate American citizens. For more, I spoke with VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, Cindy Sain.
I have been in contact with people at State, and what they are saying is that because of the dire security situation with fighting going on as we speak, basically they are telling U.S. citizens in Sudan to shelter in place. And I just spoke to a Sudan expert who's been talking to people on the ground, and he said that, yes, Americans who work at the embassy or who are at the residential compounds are sheltering in place. This person told me that the U.S. embassy is very secure. It's relatively remote in the outskirts of Khartoum. We did have an American convoy that was fired on the last couple of days. No one was injured in that. But as far as the Americans in Sudan, as well as other internationals who've been working for relief organizations, they seem to be hunkering in place, much like many of the people of Khartoum, I would imagine, at this hour.
Things are unraveling and changing by the minute. How serious or how bad will things have to get before the U.S. decides to evacuate its citizens?
I'm hearing that they're looking at several different scenarios. I'm hearing that there was a reconnaissance mission to the airport in Khartoum and that the airport could be operable. Of course, the problem would be for people to be able to get to the airport safely with fighting and firing and shelling going on. But as I'm sure many listeners will remember, those visuals of the U.S. leaving Afghanistan and Americans trying to get out and Afghans, you know, begging to please be taken along. Those were harrowing visuals, which, of course, carry also a political cost. So I'm sure that the Biden administration does not want to have something like that happen. A number of governments are drawing up plans. It's just a matter of figuring out what scenario could work.
Aside from possible plans to evacuate Americans, as well, of course, other countries planning to evacuate their citizens, are there diplomatic steps? Is the U.S. using some kind of back channel to try and get these parties to at least stop fighting or some kind of a truce?
Yes. Secretary Blinken said he's just come back from a trip to Asia, that he has been on the phone with the generals and that there are all kinds of contact with people trying to prevail to at least get a ceasefire. And that's another thing. We talked about the safety of people, to get at least a humanitarian ceasefire for some hours to allow internationals, Americans, and others who want to leave the country to get to the airport, and those who want to stay to restock their water and other supplies, and of course for people of Khartoum, residents, to also get water, because since the fighting has been on since Saturday, it's getting to be very crucial.
That's VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain speaking with me from Washington, D.C. In other news, a crowd apparently spooked by gunfire and an electrical explosion stampeded at an event to distribute financial aid during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan in Yemen's capital late Wednesday, killing at least 78 people and injuring at least 73 others, according to witnesses and Houthi rebel officials. The tragedy was the deadliest in years, and that was not related to Yemen's long-running civil war and came ahead of the Muslim holy month of Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of Ramadan later this week. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Fox News deposed of one legal threat with its $78.5 million defamation settlement with Dominion Voting Systems, but the network still faces a $2.7 billion lawsuit from another voting technology company, Smartmatic USA, over its coverage of debunked election rigging claims. Lisa Bernard of Reuters has more.
Fox News just settled one mammoth defamation lawsuit, but an even bigger and potentially more damaging case looms. The conservative news network, which shelled out nearly $788 million to Dominion Voting Systems for allegedly airing false claims that Dominion helped rig the 2020 U.S. presidential election, now faces a $2.7 billion lawsuit from another voting technology company, Smartmatic USA, which also claims Fox knowingly spread false information that its equipment was used to flip votes in favor of now President Joe Biden. Smartmatic is seeking billions in damages from Fox and five individuals, including on-air hosts and one-time lawyers for former President Donald Trump. It's unclear whether Fox will similarly settle with Smartmatic, but some experts not involved in the case say the Dominion deal, which is the largest ever defamation settlement publicly announced by an American media company, could grease the skids for an even bigger Fox payout for Smartmatic. Carrie Colonizza is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
In some ways, it's hard not to see Fox's willingness to write a check for $800 million or nearly $800 million to Dominion as not strengthening the hand of Smartmatic in its lawsuit and its negotiations in a different court.
By settling with Dominion, Fox and its parent company, Fox Corporation, averted a six-week trial with lots of media hype in exchange for half the amount of money that Dominion was seeking. Fox has firmly denied the allegations in both the Dominion and Smartmatic cases. The larger question, says Professor Colonizza, is what kind of message both cases send to the media industry.
Will it, though, sort of clean up all of the disinformation and lies and sensationalism that we see in the media today, at least in some outlets? Doubtful. But I do think they'll have to be more careful when those kinds of claims touch upon and relate to specific individuals and specific businesses and paint them in a negative light.
Fox also faces another lawsuit from a former female producer who alleges she was exposed to sexism at Fox and unjustly fired after she objected to what she claims were efforts to pressure her into giving misleading testimony in the Dominion case. Fox has called her allegations baseless.
That's Lisa Bernard of Reuters. The death toll rose to at least 29 and dozens were wounded on Wednesday from a fire at a Beijing hospital, one of the Chinese capital's deadliest in at least two decades. Rachel Graham of Reuters reports.
A fire at a Beijing hospital on Tuesday has left more than two dozen dead, making it the Chinese capital's deadliest blaze in at least two decades. Dramatic videos were posted on social media of people using tied bedsheets to escape the smoke and flames engulfing Changfeng Hospital. The majority of those who died were patients, with the fire having been put out in half an hour, officials told a media briefing. Early on Wednesday, many of those injured were still in hospital, with some in serious or critical condition, officials said, adding that initial findings showed the fire was caused by inflammable painting material at a ward under renovation, mostly impacting a wing for critically ill patients. By Wednesday, Reuters found many posts criticizing the fire on social media site WeChat had either been censored or deleted. Authorities were investigating Beijing's deadliest fire since at least 2002, when a blaze at an internet cafe killed 25.
That's Rachel Graham of Reuters.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. What are the reasons behind the epidemic of gun violence in America? And why is it so difficult to pass gun safety legislation? After numerous consecutive mass shootings from Tennessee to Alabama, it appears that guns rights activists are more dug in than ever. But proponents of gun safety legislation are equally motivated. Two very different views regarding the gun debate in America this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and issues in the news on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinodo from Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is prioritizing protecting human rights as a central pillar in U.S. foreign policy. To help reach this goal, the United States and Albania co-hosted a UN ARIA formula meeting to draw attention to systematic and widespread human rights abuses in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea. In the meeting, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, discussed how Kim Jong-un's regime fundamentally suppresses North Koreans' rights of freedom of expression, religion, and movement, both inside and outside the DPRK.
These behaviors are egregious and violations of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Speaking out against these injustices within North Korea can result in being sent to political prison camps. The DPRK continues to hold 80,000 to 120,000 people in these camps. Prisoners are subjected to further human rights abuses such as starvation, torture, gender-based violence, and inhumane conditions, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. At the ARIA, Joseph Kim, a North Korean defector, recounted his experience living in the DPRK before escaping.
I saw my father die of starvation when I was 12 years old. I lost my mom to a North Korean prison, so I went from having a loving family to being homeless.
Such testimonies shine a spotlight for the world, noted Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
For every horrifying story we hear, there are countless stories that we will never hear, that will never see the light of day. This, of course, is by design.
North Korea does everything in its power to hide its atrocities from the outside world, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. But time and time again, they have failed.
We've all seen the evidence, including the UN Commission of Inquiry report, and many since, of the DPRK's systemic, widespread, and gross human rights abuses.
We will continue to speak out against the DPRK human rights abuses and threats to international peace, said Linda Thomas-Greenfield. They may be able to shut down the voices of the people in DPRK, but they cannot shut our voices down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.